Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you tonight?
Well, I am super fantastic out here in Northern California, out here in the San Francisco Bay Area on business, and just enjoying the late spring, early summer weather here. How are you, my friend?
Doing excellent, doing excellent. We've got a huge show tonight, so we don't have a lot of time for small talk, do we?
No, we got to jump right to it here. I think the first thing I'd like to do is bring out our very special guest this evening. He's a Canadian futurist, consultant, and award-winning blogger. George Dvorsky has written and spoken extensively about the impacts of cutting-edge science and technology, particularly as they pertain to the improvement of human performance and experience. He currently serves on the board of directors for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and he blogs at Sentient Developments. George Dvorsky, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you very much. Good evening, gentlemen, and hello to everyone listening tonight.
Well, we were just saying before the show started that it's great to have you back on. I think it's been about 6 months, so you know we ought to get you on once a quarter, I think. We ought to do like about every...
That sounds good to me. That sounds good to me. I always have a great time when you invite me to speak on Fast Forward Radio. So yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Yeah, we're gonna start scheduling you more often. We always have so much to catch up. Of course, it seems like typically when we've had John, we've just been like extended it an additional week or two since the conversation just keeps going. Not that that will happen tonight.
Yes, exactly.
Well, we need to turn the tables on Phil, George, just a little bit. You and I need to kind of co-host for a second and ask Phil a little bit about his experience this weekend.
Yes, rumor has it that there was a screening of a rather famous futurist this past weekend. Do you want to share the experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I had the very distinct pleasure of attending what's billed as the world premiere of the film version of The Singularity Is Near. This was at the Breckenridge Film Festival in Breckenridge, Colorado. I think this is the first time I've ever been to the world premiere of a movie, so that was kind of cool in and of itself. I tweeted the whole experience, and one of my just off the cuff comments is that Breckenridge, lovely town, beautiful mountain ski town for anyone who gets the opportunity to go there, highly recommended. But as far as the film festival goes, Sundance this ain't. Okay, they've got a few they got a few quirks to work out of the system. We were having some I would say medium to severe projector issues for the two short features leading up to The Singularity Is Near. But luckily, they got it all sorted by the time The Singularity Is Near started, so we were able to watch that unhindered. And let me just give my very quick synopsis of my review. I found the movie to be outstanding. I was very much impressed that they pulled it off. As I said in my written review, it's really two movies. There is a documentary, which is Ray talking with usual suspects, Eric Drexler and Marvin Minsky and Aubrey de Grey and others about the topics that we read about in the book, The Singularity Is Near. And then there's fictional storyline. There's a kind of a science fiction story going on about Ramona, Ray's female alter ego and artificial intelligence daughter, and her efforts to become recognized as human. And I think that's actually where the movie really shines. I found the story of Ramona to be very engaging and surprisingly moving. Although it's not played up as a big emotional kind of a story. The whole movie is, I think, very lighthearted and is presented with a good deal of humor, which I think is effective. And of course, if you know Ray Kurzweil's writing style, that's how he presents information anyway. But the story, I have a personal history with Ramona, as longtime listeners of this program will know, in that I published the first ever interview that she ever gave some years ago. This was from a series of chats that I did with her and kind of edited the transcripts into interview form in the at the Speculist. And Ramona and I had one encounter right towards the end that I'll just read how our original discussion ended. When I said to her, "May I ask you one more question?" And she says, "All right, anyway." And I said, me speaking to Ramona, "Will you remember me when the singularity comes?" And her answer was, "Of course I remember you well, Philip A. Bauermaster." So this answer, as I point out in my review, just a chatbot glitch. No doubt the "I remember you well" is a little bit of a boilerplate that she says to anyone who asks if she remembers them. But she's speaking in the present tense, even though I've asked her a question about whether she's going to remember me after this future date. But when I read that, I can't help but have this kind of, I don't know, almost wistful projection towards the future when these constructs that we interact with now, some of which might actually evolve into people. It's a very Pinocchio story of Ramona hoping to become not a real girl, but actually having become a real sentient conscious being and asking to be recognized as such. And I don't think I'm giving away too much to tell you that, of course, she achieved that objective. And in the very end of the movie, she's talking to all of us, talking to us in the audience, and asking us to come join her in that future world that she has created. And I found that to be a wonderful moment, and really just a very, I think, entertaining and well-made movie. I think it will, if it's given an opportunity to, I think it will speak well to a broad audience, and I think it will be a great introduction to some of these kinds of ideas to folks who maybe haven't had the opportunity to learn about this up to now or to think about these things up to now.
Wow, you certainly piqued my interest. I didn't realize that the film had this kind of, I guess, level to it. And that very interesting to hear that it has at least a pair of narratives that run through it. How would you describe, like, what were the production values like? Like, was it a really decent, professional, slick-looking film?
Absolutely. The interview portions, very very professionally made, well made. There are some very nice CGI, but I will say that I'm watching this off a DVD projected in a kind of a funky theater in Breckenridge, so I can't speak absolutely to the clarity and the quality of the computer graphics. I thought they looked quite good, and we weren't completely overwhelmed by them, but I thought they supported the narrative quite well as Ray is explaining a story. And then art direction of Ramona's evolution, I thought, was quite well handled. It's nothing overwhelming, but when we first see her, she is attempting to chat with some folks in Second Life, and it's these very clunky, jittery Second Life type movements that are going on, and the fake head coming back to laugh kind of moves that we've all seen, maybe a couple years ago in Second Life, and she's immediately spotted out as a bot. But we watch her progress, and as she becomes more intelligent, we're also to understand that the visual technology that can render her becomes increasingly realistic until she's I guess it's just the actress portraying her at that point that you're not even seeing any CGI at all, although there's still special effects going on. But the transition from the one to the other, I thought, was handled very well, and it kind of added a sort of a counterpoint or a punctuation to the overall narrative of her progression from a simple chatbot to a being more intelligent than any of us.
Now, I'm imagining that it was fairly accessible and probably scripted in a way that appeals to a wider audience. Well, what I'm kind of interested in knowing is, was there any kind of like a critical eye or even kind of self-reflectiveness to it? I mean, were some challenging questions posed in terms of some of the predictions and some of the questions that are put forth by some of the critics? Or was it, I worry that it was a little too kind of maybe lacking that kind of element to it? I mean, I'll let you answer that now.
Well, I think that, you know, that is an issue that Ray takes very seriously. And, you know, in the book, he spends a good deal of time talking about critiques that have come from sources as diverse as Ned Ludd, Bill Joy, the Unabomber, right? I mean, he talks through them. And although he concludes, and I think rightly, that the smart money is on we will overcome those risks and we will move on to something better. I think he contends with those issues and he takes them very seriously. And Bill Joy is featured prominently in the film in the interviews. And in fact, the part of the plot in the Ramona storyline is her trying to head off a Grey Goo nanotech meltdown, which apparently someone is trying to trigger. And there's a little bit of a mystery around who's behind this attack and interesting dynamics because she's trying to do it and she's just an AI, mistrust from the government and inability to access the things she needs to do to keep it from happening. So I think, you know, the risks are addressed. I think maybe people who would like to see a more serious treatment of the risks might not be completely satisfied with the treatment they receive here, but it's certainly not completely glossed over. And as you know, Bill Joy isn't going to pull any punches when he talks about those things.
Okay. Definitely have to catch this now.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. I highly recommend it.
This film is headed next to New York City and other major markets like that. Try to kind of slowly build a wider opening. Is that the idea?
That's the idea. I spoke to the director and to Ray about that, and yeah, they're hoping that this screening in New York, which by the way is sponsored by Time Life, will attract sufficient attention that a distributor will pick it up. They're very much hoping that it will make its way into the theaters ahead of a DVD release, but certainly at least a DVD release is likely in the very near future. I hope it makes it onto some movie screens because I think it's definitely worthy of that.
Well, any chance that this audience has to check it out, I hope you guys will take. I know that I'll go check it out if it's in any major market, you know, halfway near where I am. I'm gonna make the trip to see it.
Sure. Well, as soon as we've got information on that, of course, we'll make that available too. So, highly recommend it. And that was one small thing that happened this weekend. But now we're going to shift gears, and I'm going to go back into interview mode. Let's talk about the other much bigger thing that happened over the weekend, and of course that would be the Humanity Plus Summit at Harvard. And we were able to cover that event to a certain extent on The Speculist. Again, our great thanks to Leslie Kirshner for filling in as a guest blogger and providing some terrific coverage of that event at The Speculist. And also, Stephen, I thought you did an outstanding job of keeping us up to date on the live streaming of the event. But what we've really got to do now is we've got George on the line. Let's get a firsthand insider's view. What's the big news from the H Plus Summit, George?
That's that's a good question, and I don't think there's really one simple answer. I have just a thousand different things that I could share, and it's kind of even difficult to know where to begin. What I can tell you is I just got back in yesterday. The event was at Harvard near Boston, and drove with a pair of friends the 11 hours from Toronto to both to speak there and to attend there. And quite tired by the whole experience. It was overwhelming for the 2.5 days that I was there. And it, you might even hear it on my voice. My voice is still a little bit hoarse because I literally have not stopped talking in the last 3 or 4 days. And it was just an absolutely tremendous experience. And I would say mostly in terms of it being a very, very positive experience. And specifically what the event was, just for, I guess, for the purposes of an overview, it was the Humanity Plus Summit at Harvard, The Rise of the Citizen Scientist. And Humanity Plus, of course, is one of the premier, if not the premier, futurist organization in the world that deals specifically with issues as they pertain to human enhancement, or what others would refer to as transhumanism. And in fact, this is the organization that was formerly known, in fact, as the World Transhumanist Association, and it recently went through some rebranding. And they've held conferences annually. In the past, it was Transvision, and now it's been again remodeled a little way as the summits. And the summits have been held in various locations, and I believe this is the first time they've ever held one at Harvard. And it was certainly my first opportunity to visit that campus and to walk around and check it out. It was really as spectacular as I was hoping and as I was expecting. So the theme being Rise of the Citizen Scientist, with the organizers and the organizers being primarily David Orban and Alex Lightman of Humanity Plus, they basically said, you know, you can pretty much talk about whatever you want to talk in regards to the future, of course, and in specifically in terms of human enhancement issues, but it has to bounce back off this idea of the rise of the citizen scientist. And what they meant by that was this general feeling, kind of a continuation of a trend that really did start as early or as long as 300, 400 years ago, where you started to have just regular individuals in society who didn't really need to be fancy scientists or, you know, working in institutions, just basically using the tools that were finally made available around them and making some pretty interesting breakthroughs. One of the most famous examples, of course, is Albert Einstein, who worked as a clerk and on the side was, you know, doing nothing less than forming, you know, theories of, you know, relativity. And there's so many other examples of individuals who are able to do this. And what they're trying to foster here early in the 21st century, in light of accessibility to so much technology, and they bring up such a good point. The average person has never had at their disposal the kind of tools that they have today, whether it be information technologies or communication technologies, or just simply, of course, machines that can crunch numbers and machines in which we can lay out the kinds of visions that we have. And the general feeling is that given enough motivation and empowering people to realize that, you know, you can be the citizen scientist and you can make a difference. You can go about this kind of inquiry and create your own groups or organizations and kind of forge ahead and develop these sorts of things. That was exactly the kind of message that they were hoping to give across. So that was kind of the overarching theme of the conference, and every speaker there had to kind of weave that message into their talks. But if you guys have like specific questions or like specific you know, angles that you want to pursue, I mean, feel free to pose a question. I'll certainly do my best to answer them.
Well, let's start with what because we want to talk. We obviously want to get into your own talk with you a little bit later. But just of the different talks you saw, which two or three would you say made the biggest impression? Were there any aha kind of surprise moments? That you hadn't expected to hear that made the event especially for you?
There were definitely some standouts, and for me personally, it was Stephen Wolfram's talk, and Stephen Wolfram gave the keynote at the end of the first day. Of course, Stephen Wolfram, the author of Mathematica, A New Kind of Science, and most listeners, I think, will be familiar with him simply through the Wolfram Alpha answer engine. And to have Stephen at the event was pretty extraordinary in my opinion, and it was one of the reasons why I kind of even made an effort to head on down there. I thought it was going to be just a great opportunity to hear him speak and even maybe get a chance to meet him. And it was really interesting because, first of all, Every speaker, well, not every speaker, but the vast majority of the speakers were only given about 10-minute time slots because there were just it was just such an overwhelming response in terms of the speakers wanting to talk and a reluctance on the part of the organizers to have breakout rooms. I mean, the feeling was they wanted everybody to partake in all the talks, and they didn't want the feeling that anyone was missing anything. So what it did was it kind of forced everybody to speak within 10 to 15-minute presentation. So everybody's talk was very concise, and it was very back-to-back-to-back-to-back type of a delivery. But thankfully, they gave Mr. Wolf from pretty much the entire hour with which he could stand in front of the audience and talk about his the various things that he wants to talk about. And what was really interesting, very early on in his talk, he basically had, and quite ironically enough, particularly at a transhumanist type of an event, and even more ironically considering that he is the real great advocate of computationalism and of course, the usage of computers, his presentation broke down. And he was unable to progress through the slides like he had wanted to. I think specifically a pair of videos were causing some real nastiness with his presentation. And you'd think something like that would throw him or, you know, maybe make for even a mediocre talk. But you know what? At the risk of sounding Luddite here, sometimes I think the slides can maybe be a bit of a distraction and maybe a bit of a crutch even. So he basically said, okay, it is what it is. I'm going to stand in front of you guys for the next 4 to 5 minutes, and I'm just going to talk to you. And he did a kind of a stream of consciousness thing, and I thought, okay, I kind of kicked back, and this is going to be great. And basically, it was listening to Stephen Wolfram just talk about his career and what interested him early on, and the various phases he's had in his life and his three major projects, mainly the Mathematica, the new kind of science, and of course the Wolfram Alpha. But also, what was unique for this particular audience, and this is again what I'm really thankful for, was he admitted that he very very rarely speaks about the future, and he very rarely makes any kind of predictions or speculates about where we're headed or what in advanced intelligence looks like. And he kind of basically figured, if there's any group out there that I'm going to share my ideas with, it's going to be you guys. So it was a real treat to be in that audience. And toward the end of his talk, for example, he was in fact doing that. He was talking about he talked about SETI specifically, where he thought SETI, what he thought they were doing right and what he thought they were doing wrong, why they haven't necessarily heard anything yet from extraterrestrials, and then speculating even further afield to thinking about the human trajectory and the potential for human intelligence and trying to reconcile that with the Fermi paradox. And I know that these are subjects that interest you guys greatly, and it certainly is one of that fascinates me. So to hear Stephen talk about that was excellent. And just perhaps to share a little bit of his insight, he has a kind of feeling that they are in fact out there, but they have no interest in colonization, which is something I actually agree with also. But that doesn't mean that the signs of their activities are completely invisible. He says they're probably invisible to us now because to us it just looks like nature. It just looks like natural phenomena. And that given some more sophistication in our scientific understanding and even technological understanding, we might start to look out into the starry night and say, you know what, that's actually probably a sign of an artificial that's a sign of an advanced intelligence. Which is kind of an interesting thing to say, and that was kind of the angle, one of the angles. I mean, he wasn't saying that that's in fact the case. Like any good scientist, he's positing an hypothesis. And similarly, while he was kind of
did he by any chance give any examples of something that might pan out that way? Or
absolutely, he actually said that one of the things that we might be able to identify. And by the way, part of what I'm saying now is a hybrid of his talk and the 45 minutes I was able to, I basically cornered him in the lobby and just started to engage in conversation with him. So this is a combination of his keynote / George and Stephen having a talk about Fermi paradox in the corner of the lobby. It was quite a wonderful experience. It was definitely for me personal
highlight. Oh,
exclusive
interview.
Yeah, personal. I wouldn't call it so much an interview as me cornering Stephen and basically saying, you and I are going to talk about this now, because when am I ever going to have an opportunity like that? By the way, I pulled a similar thing in Chicago about two or three years ago when Marvin Minsky was there. Same deal. Like, when am I ever going to get a chance to talk Fermi paradox with Marvin Minsky? It's going to be now, and I basically did that as well. It was quite wonderful. So yeah, so Stephen, his idea was, or one of the things that he said that we might identify as being extraterrestrial in origin, would be star realignment. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with that. I know that a number of writers, including Anders Sandberg. I mean, Anders Sandberg has an unbelievably radical vision for a mega scale project. Never mind, you know, your Dyson spheres and your Jupiter brains. Anders is talking about collecting masses of stars together for even greater mega scale project. Probably like this, which is called hyperscale. I don't know. You'd have to ask Anders. But anyways, that's the kind of thing that Stephen was talking about. Not so specifically. He was perhaps not thinking to the degree that Anders Sandberg is thinking, but still speculating that an ETI would go about the business, whether it be artistic or for aesthetic purposes or for engineering purposes, to rearrange the stars. So, again, that's something that would not necessarily be something we could identify right now, as we wouldn't know what specifically to look for in terms of their orientation. He also, kind of ringing back to his keynote, was it's so difficult for us to project where we're headed as a species, because just because we can do a thing doesn't mean we're going to do a thing. That is very hard often to project what our needs are going to be. And this is, again, where I agree with him completely, is if we're going to start predicting things, it's all fine and well sometimes to think about what we can, I mean, the wonderful things that we can do with technology, but oftentimes we are, I wouldn't say so much constrained, but there's often a reality to our technological innovations. Let's take, for example, the possibility that we're going to be developing technologies that will clean our environment, the so-called remedial ecology movement, and taking carbon out of the atmosphere. I mean, if we didn't have a global warming crisis, we wouldn't go about inventing those things. So that's just kind of an example of where, you know, projecting where the things that we invent and even where we head as a species will have to be grounded in our purpose and whatever, I guess, whatever kind of needs we'll have in future. So that's kind of what he's trying to think further ahead to advanced ETIs. And the other things that he said, again, even quite whimsically, is like, for all we know, pulsars and even gamma ray bursters may be signs of extraterrestrial activity. Although I would suspect when he said gamma ray bursters, what he was suggesting is they probably had a very awful accident of some sort, because I can't see for the life of me why an ETI would voluntarily want to ignite something of that power. Gamma ray bursters, of course, having the kind of explosive capacity to wipe out even quadrants of entire galaxies in terms of their sterilization potential. So that was a treat. That was an absolute delight. And of course, he didn't just talk about Fermi issues and SETI issues. He talked about the computational nature of the universe, or at least the potential in terms of understanding the universe as a largely computational construct, and that ultimately, you know, we're kind of inspired by automata and how that works with simple rule-based, very simple rules can turn into some rather complex and unexpected things, right on through to thinking of the universe as being an expression of algorithms, that gravity may be just some kind of an algorithm out there that's being expressed, maybe not literally by a computer, but certainly the metaphor helps understand how it is that the universe actually functions. So that was Stephen Wolfram. Another talk, kind of switching gears here a little bit, maybe not necessarily as in a kind of a mind-blowing talk in that sort of a sense, but more of an example of how, the citizen scientist is kind of working away and doing things. It had been quite a while since a friend of mine and colleague John Smart had made an appearance at one of these events. You guys are familiar with John Smart, right?
We know John. He's a good friend.
Okay, I knew you would be. And so John's there. He's got these mutton chop sideburns now. It took me a while to recognize him, and it was wonderful to see him again. I thought it's going to be interesting to see why he came out, because I kind of had a feeling that he's been working on something. And in fact, he is. He, along with another colleague who also presented there, who actually is working at Harvard, they are proposing an alternative to cryonics in terms of the ability to preserve brains. And of course, preserving brains is the whole idea behind eventual reanimation, the idea where you could, after death, have your brain preserved in hopes that a future civilization will reanimate you and revive you and introduce you back into society in some shape or form. And the only real paradigm right now for that has been freezing the brain. So that's the only thing we can do right now. As of today, the only thing we can do that's doing even a modest job of preserving the brain as it was at the moment of death is, in fact, cryonics. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's how we're going to do it. I suspect that cryonics will be it will appear rather old-fashioned and clunky and even anachronistic in a few years. That's a feeling that I've had for a while. And I've heard of others even speculate of such things like a warm biostasis, where we'll be using, some pretty fancy biotechnology and even potentially some nanotechnology to keep and preserve the brain state as it was at the moment of death. But John had something here that I hadn't really heard before that he presented to the audience, and that is brain preservation through plastination. And it's exactly as it sounds. Basically, if you're familiar with the Body Works exhibits that have been making the rounds around various museums, it is the idea that you can actually preserve cellular structure through plastics. And that's obviously a bit of a gross generalization. It's much more sophisticated than that. The number of chemicals that they use and the stages vary. Everything from initially perfusing the brain with this chemical, capturing its state exactly, and then again continuing to apply different sorts of chemicals and so on, such that you can store the brain indefinitely. And that you have the information theoretic component of the brain largely preserved, such that someday maybe you can revive yourself as a whether it be an uploaded being or something maybe like a cyberguised or even a biological body. It's difficult to kind of project at this point. So they had this idea, and they created what's called the Brain Preservation Foundation. And if you Google that, you can find it. And it's not even as straightforward as that in terms of their approach. They have kind of got an XPRIZE element to this as well, where they're asking for donors to contribute to the prize. And what they really want is to give they're trying to instigate and facilitate the development of brain preservation technology. And really, as far as they're concerned, you know what, if they lose in terms of their concept, it's all good because, you know, we've actually achieved what we're looking to achieve, which is a potential for, you know, indefinite lifespan and certainly potential to thwart death. So if you want to still pursue the cryonics angle, you're welcome to do so, and you might actually one day win the Brain Preservation Prize. And they announced that they've already had a major donor donate $100,000, which is pretty remarkable if you think about it.
Wow.
So the first team to successfully preserve the brain will win this award. And some of your listeners might be wondering, well, why hasn't cryonics received that award yet? Unfortunately, as excellent as an organization, Alcor and other groups are, every single preservation that has taken place so far has had some kind of problem, namely through the things such as fracturing. Basically, every brain has kind of cracked like an ice cube does when it's kind of been thrown into a glass, and we can only really wonder and hope what kind of preservation has actually happened, and we still don't even know necessarily what has happened as a result of crystallization and the damage that is happening to each cell. I guess what they're really suggesting is we haven't proved one way or another that the cryonics model is actually working. Maybe it is. Maybe what I've said is actually not as detrimental to the brain as I think it is. But until we prove that, John and his group there are not going to award anybody this money.
Yeah,
so,
certainly we hope on behalf of all those who have taken that leap with Alcor that it's working and that pans out. But the plastination is actually, this is a topic we talked about with Stephen about a couple of months ago.
Something I've kind of wondered about, George and Phil, is that, you know, how do you plasticize deep within the brain without disturbing portions of the brain that are further on the outside? I don't know why, but that just strikes me as that interesting how you can plasticize a whole organ like that
right.
And not leave out portions of it.
On this particular issue, you certainly have exhausted my knowledge on the subject. This was news to me just as of the weekend. I am sorry that I missed your show from a few months ago. I would have been fascinated to have heard that. But what I can tell you is, and maybe this has something to do with it, but one of John's colleagues there, I'm just going to call up his name right now. I know his first name was Ken.
Ken Hayward.
Ken Hayward. Thank you. Thank you, Phil. He works right there at the Harvard Neuroscience Imaging Lab. And here was another treat that some of us attendees had at the conference. Those who wanted a tour of the facility were welcome to, and I joined a group of about 10 or 12 people. I was joined by James Hughes of the IEET. Ronald Bailey came along from Reason Magazine. He's their science correspondent. And Ramez Nam, the author of More Than Human, joined us. And so it was a great group of people and others, and we were quite literally taken to the bowels of Harvard University. We went to an adjoining building, and we went into an elevator, and I think it took us down a couple of floors, so we were quite low underground. It was literally kind of fascinating and sublime in this sort of a way. And then we were greeted by the sign, you know, neuroimaging lab, and the next thing you knew, we were in Ken's lab there, and we got to see his amazing electron microscope that he had kind of jerry-rigged for this exact purpose, which is the task of not just examining brain at a very small scale, but the whole act of brain slicing as well. I held in my hand for a while the cortex of a mouse that was so thin they could only measure it in terms of the nanometer scale, and this is what they're doing is they're looking at the brain at such a minute scale now as to be mind-boggling. The moment for me of realization as to what they were actually doing came when on the wall they had blown up a rather large-sized poster of the brain at 5,000 nanometers across. And because it was so large, you were actually looking, when you were just looking at a tiny little speck, let's say, on the corner of the picture, you realize that, and they said as much, you're looking at a resolution of 5 nanometers. It was just unbelievable. And what you can see at 5 nanometers, you are literally seeing the neurotransmitters linking the various parts of the brain. So you're almost quite literally seeing neurotransmission being bounced from part to part to part of the brain as part of brain function. It was really quite remarkable. And at the same time, as they were displaying all this to us, they were trying to convey to us how this is relating to the brain preservation work that they're doing. Everything from how they plan on streamlining the process, how they plan on automating the process, and basically trying to make it they want to make this as scalable as possible. They basically see this kind of thing hitting a certain critical mass, and they've got to be able to produce brain preservations en masse. So they're even talking about eventually integrating robots into the process, for example, in terms of the handling and the processing of all this sort of stuff. So these guys have pretty big visions. And Stephen, I think you'd have to ask them specifically in terms of the exact science, in terms of how they're going to perfuse the brain in its entirety, which is, I think, a fair question to ask. I'm sure they must clearly have an answer for that. But, what was also kind of jaw-dropping for me is, you know, oftentimes I kind of try to take a step back and think of myself, am I a little too close to, you know, to this kind of scene from a futurist's perspective, from a hopeful futurist perspective, and is there enough science to support a lot of our speculations and our predictions and our whimsy? And to actually be, you know, in a real lab with real scientists, with real equipment, doing real research and seeing this firsthand, and at the same time realizing that these are the same individuals who are working on trying to preserve brains. It was kind of a moment where, like, you know what? You know, this is actually happening. Like, it's really, really happening. And this isn't just, you know, guys like me sitting in my armchair just thinking about the possibilities and thinking, is this theoretically possible? These guys are taking it from it being theoretically possible to actually rolling up their sleeves and actually trying to do it. So that was kind of a moment I had, one of those kind of aha moments that you were asking for earlier that I had, and that was definitely one of them, was there at Ken's lab.
Really, really exciting stuff. In fact, it was Ken's website I had seen a link to that on Michael Anisimov's blog that got us talking about that a few weeks ago, and I mentioned on the program that I had had a conversation with a prominent member of the futurist community who was also interested in this area and was putting together funding for an XPRIZE type funding for this kind of research, and I couldn't go public with who it was because he hadn't announced it yet, but now I can say, by the way, no big surprise now, it's smart. So for anyone who wondered who I was talking to, that kind of closes the loop on that. So that's really exciting that that's gone public and that they've got it sounds like a good bit of funding to get the ball rolling, and I bet that grows significantly.
Yeah.
Because that is just a fascinating new avenue for how to pursue this. And you know what's interesting about that, George, is it seems to imply, as you were suggesting, that there might be multiple ways to do this. That we're probably only just scratching the surface on what methods for how the brain and the mind might be preserved.
Yeah, and like I said, at some point we may look back on the current era and maybe laugh a little bit at our naivety in terms of what we thought we could do in terms of brain preservation. But you know, it's all good. I think right now, let's not make any mistakes in overstating this. The best option right now is cryonics. There is nothing really else.
Right.
What we're saying is that maybe 10 years down the line, or if John and Ken are super ambitious and productive, maybe sooner than that. Or like I suggested, the warm preservation schemas or what have you, or something we haven't even thought of. That's definitely an area to keep our eyes on for sure.
Absolutely. Well, let's shift gears, George. We want to talk a little bit about the talk that you gave. And, Stephen, you want to get the ball rolling on questions for George about that?
Well, I understand, George, that there were aspects of the talk that ended up proving controversial. Could you explain to us why that is? Why what you were talking about would be controversial with that audience at all?
Right, and I even went to Harvard knowing that and even expecting and perhaps even wanting to kind of raise a little bit of controversy. And specifically what it's about is the disconnect that there often is between I'm not just going to say just animal rights or even personhood rights, animal personhood rights, but even when it comes to ethics and bioethics in particular, there seems sometimes in transhumanist circles to be a bit of a reaction against that. So there's kind of two issues there in terms of controversy. We'll deal with one each at a time. What I spoke about, and the bridge that I tried to kind of gap here, was I was speaking specifically about artificial consciousness as differentiated from artificial intelligence. Consciousness, of course, being that subset of intelligence that gives rise to subjective awareness, where you now have agency in the intelligence itself. So for us, of course, we describe it as consciousness, more specifically as qualia. So the ability to actually, as a functioning agent in your environment, having that qualitative subjective feeling that you have in your environment. So whereas intelligence is strictly the kind of even brute calculation that our brains do, even a calculator can do, that a computer can do. And, of course, what you guys were – what Phil was talking about earlier through the Kurzweil movie, what even Ramona can do. That's not consciousness. That's not subjective awareness. That's not anything that's deserving of any moral consideration. And here's where I, as the ethicist, have something to say about it. And specifically what my concern is as work is going to progress in this field, and I'm almost certain it did, and I spent the first half of my talk basically, or at least portions of my talk, saying that, look, we're heading there. We are isolating the neural correlates of consciousness, what are also known as NCC. In other words, those aspects of intelligence that give rise to conscious awareness specifically, that as we're working to create synthetic consciousness or artificial consciousness, what's going to happen in the labs or the computer labs, or it might be a, you know, if I'm correct and Ray Kurzweil is correct and if Andrew Sandberg is correct, it'll come probably first through whole brain emulation rather than from an AGI approach, like the Ben Goetzel type approach. But regardless of how it comes about, through which of those strategies, what you're going to have is what was once an experiment or a piece of code or a chunk of synthesized brain, what was once even a piece of property, now has transcended that status and now enters into the realm of something that is morally worthy and that is deserving of ethical consideration. So it goes from property to being, you know, a conscious being that needs to be protected by ethical codes, or more specifically, something more pragmatically, legal protections. So backtracking a little bit, and why this is even potentially controversial as well, and why I desperately tried to weave the animal rights aspect into it, is I'm trying to set up something here that's preemptive and to set up some precedents. And I feel that it's through the animal rights channel that we can do this, that if we can protect animals better than we are protecting them now, and specifically if we can protect animal or non-human animal persons. And what I mean by a non-human animal person, that's a very special subset of non-human animals that would contain such animals as elephants, the great apes, cetaceans, possibly even encephalopods and some birds like the great parrot. So very sophisticated kind of animals in which they have very very complex social arrangements and in intense capacities for a broad spectrum of emotional responses and so on. That if we initially start to respect and establish the precedents to protect those persons and those life forms, then we're going to be in a good position where when artificial consciousness emerges, that we'll have laws in place that are going to be easily extensible to that realm, into machine consciousness in particular. And I was accused of bringing PETA into the conference, and same with David Pierce was also accused of that, another bioethicist who spoke about reducing, he was talking about ending suffering. David Pierce, I'm sure, is a name that's familiar to many of your listeners, an ethicist from England. He is, along with Nick Bostrom, co-founded the World Transhumanist Association many years ago and is the author of The Hedonistic Imperative. So he and I, we were accused of bringing quote-unquote PETA into the discussion, which none of us even talked about that particular organization, nor do I even really care to talk about that organization. And that we kind of were pushing our own agendas, so to speak. So there was that kind of aspect there. And kind of another issue was resentment toward ethicists being at the conference. And this is, I think, something you get in particular with a more libertarian-leaning crowd, which is what you certainly get when you go to a transhumanist event, that basically anytime, you know, you stand up and start to talk about, you know, government regulations, restrictions, you know, tales of caution, and of course, you know, having ethicists there saying that you should probably not do that, you raise the ire of a lot of people. And again, it's very easy perhaps to probably target some of the trollish type of behavior on things like Twitter and Facebook, but there was some of that, that kind of sub-level communication going on after my talk where that, you know, why do we have ethicists here at this conference? Which to me was kind of laughable because I said to James Hughes, I said, yeah, heaven forbid that you'd want to have ethicists at a conference on human enhancement.
We're not going to need ethics in the future. We don't need your ethics, man. Jeez, what are you bringing us down for? Oh,
ridiculous.
Wow.
So
that's outrageous.
So back to my talk. So that's what that's what I was trying to talk about. So what I also did was other issues. Again, I probably tried not probably. I most certainly tried to say way too much in the 10 minutes that I have. I even extended it. I think when all was said and done, I actually spoke for 16 minutes, which still doesn't sound like much. I have this vision in my mind of David Orban looking at me doing that, you know, cutting symbol with the hand over the neck, desperately got to stop now. And Alex Levin was more relaxed, like, whatever.
Hook, right, Alex gets the hook and pulls it off.
But David was freaking. Yeah, freaking. And I didn't see it the same kind of, you know, well, whatever. But the other things that I spoke of in my talk was a bit of a critique of the Turing test. And the Turing test, of course, is the very famous test that basically is supposed to be this test that's going to help us identify when something is conscious. We, as it stands right now, we have absolutely no way of knowing that, you know, what is conscious and what is not. It's just an empirical thing that we do. It's just something that we assume intuitively. I assume you guys are conscious and you guys reciprocate that feeling. And you know, and we're all happy as a result of it. And life goes on just under that assumption. Pretty amazing if you think about it. But that's all we got. And I think the Turing test doesn't really do a satisfactory job kind of answering that. And I put up a bunch of reasons why. For example, it's a strictly behavioral test that's really only trying to elicit a behavior. Like Ramona is a great example of this, where it's just a preset set, already kind of chatbot, it's just a preset set of responses that try to kind of, based on a set of rules, give you a response. But there's no thinking going on there. There's no introspection or, reflecting on what it is that you're actually asking. There's no, again, subjectivity there to it. So
right.
Another thing is, I mean, it's a poor measure of intelligence as well. Kind of conflates intelligence with consciousness. And even with intelligence, I mean, intelligence is such a fuzzy, murky, gray thing. Like, it's such an imperfect thing. It's one of those things that's just kind of good enough. I mean, everybody's got their idiosyncrasies. We all are, you know, we all have our foibles. We're completely imperfect. And I think that we kind of have this idea through a Turing test that if it actually exhibited some kind of fault, that it actually wouldn't be conscious. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that's kind of part of what are many issues that are wrong with the Turing test. And where I went from there was I said that basically this is kind of the approach with the Turing test is simply this, that if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. And that is completely unscientific and completely unsatisfactory. What we need to do is as Richard Feynman once said, he said, if I cannot build it, I do not understand it. So what I was saying basically was that we have to build the duck if we're going to understand it. In other words, we have to build a brain and know functionally what is it exactly in the brain that is giving rise to conscious awareness. First, we've got to understand how that works in the human brain, or any kind of brain that has conscious capacity. Figure out how that works in the human brain. Know what are the neural correlates of consciousness in the human brain. Then we have to try to figure out, okay, now that we know what causes consciousness, what kind of set of traits, functions, now let's try to make that an artificial form, whether it be through a different kind of a substrate or maybe whether it through be some kind of fancy script, which I'm doubtful that that's in fact the case. But I'm sure there's something computational about consciousness. Again, I am a functionalist when it comes to my feeling about how consciousness actually works. And it's through that we'll – sorry, go ahead.
When you say you're a functionalist about how consciousness works, could you explain what that means?
Basically, it is the general feeling that every aspect of the brain, whether it be intelligence or consciousness, can be understood computationally or functionally.
Oh,
that there's
okay.
Nothing. There's nothing vitalistic about it. There's nothing magical about it. There's nothing that is kind of intractable in terms of being able to identify how it actually works. And why
and
that
yet,
needs
at
to
the same
be.
Time, what I hear you saying is that there's such a thing as consciousness, because it seems like the Turing test definition and a lot of the language you hear around consciousness is that, well, we don't really know what it is. It's subjective. It's a mystery. Sometimes you get the whole it's an illusion.
Right. Yeah.
And it's sort of like whatever it is doesn't matter. Seems to be kind of the.
Yeah, and I don't
think it's not the predominant view, it's a very popular view.
Yeah, it is, and I put that I had a slide that basically had that point put there, that there's a lot of denialism, defeatism, and even just ignorance about kind of hand waving and just, or even just throwing the hands in the air and saying that we'll just gloss over that, we'll kind of figure it out, it's an emergent thing, you know, blah 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 blah. What I would suggest is, and there were people that knew a lot more about this subject. I mean, I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm basically I try to limit my kind of intellectual, you know, realms within ethics in particular. But if you're going to engage in ethics, you got to understand at least a little bit of this stuff. But there were people there that knew a lot more than I did about this topic, and they were talking about artificial consciousness and that we can build it, we can make it somehow. So there's this growing feeling, that's kind of, you're asking again, kind of interpretations of the conference. There were a number of talks that were specifically neuroscience-based and consciousness-based that weren't even specifically talking about enhancement, but just saying that, you know, before we can even get into the, you know, AIs and the enhancement aspects, we've still got to get a handle on this particular problem, which is obviously known as the hard problem. So, yeah, just to kind of summarize my talk and basically just saying that once we can identify a machine as having consciousness, and that's the whole point, is being able to, we don't have to guess and use the looks like a duck, quacks like a duck approach. The proof is in the pudding approach will be much better. We'll know that, okay, this thing has the same requisite functionality that the human brain does for consciousness. It must be conscious. So back to the kind of ethical side of it. Now this object ceases to become this thing that you can poke and prod and manipulate and shut down and mess around with, because now the law kind of comes in and it says, okay, you, Mr. AI theorist, you now are dealing with something that is worthy of moral consideration. So I kind of put up, I'm just, you know, this is, I think, kind of like first generation consideration. And again, maybe my opinions will be considered naive at some point, but I kind of thought, okay, where do we start? And I basically said, well, first of all, if the AC, artificial consciousness, qualifies as a full-blown person in the same way that I've kind of talked how elephants and dolphins and humans are persons, and I also flashed what I meant by that. We probably don't have time to go over that, but that if in fact does qualify for personhood consideration, it's deserving of the same kind of fundamental freedoms and fundamental rights that that would afford any person, human or otherwise. So, again, just trying to get that across to the transhumanists and anyone involved in this issue that it doesn't matter what you're made out of. It doesn't matter if you're made out of biological material or synthetic material. If you have certain capacities, you qualify as, you know, under having protections you know, based on where you live, I suppose. And so I need to get into some specifics here. So, for example, an artificial consciousness that's sophisticated enough will have the right to not have its source code manipulated. In fact, it should probably even have right of ownership at that point over its source code. It deserves the right to not be shut down. It deserves the right to privacy, in particular, the right to access its own mental states and not to have those mental states or any other kind of internal state exposed to somebody else, namely maybe the public or the researcher. Unless, of course, it's consensual, which, again, that kind of goes without saying. And, you know, just to say it in addition that, you know, we should probably think as well about protecting such things as, you know, even here today, not having gene patenting allowed, ownership over your body, ownership over your mind, because if we don't start to protect these things today, that there would be, you know, some pretty potentially negative ramifications in the future for, you know, non-biologically substrate entities. So that's how I ended my presentation, and not that I want to dwell like on the controversy or on the negatives. I mean, I had a lot of people afterwards, you know, say this is really kind of cool. It's so amazing that you're thinking about these things kind of preemptively and bringing ethics into the discussion and kind of reminding people that, you know, there isn't a willy-nilly aspect to this, that we are going to hit a point where these issues will in fact become quite important. So it was wonderful to get those kinds of responses as well.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about the kind of basic rights that would apply. It seems that those are the same rights that we would apply to ourselves, right? That I don't want anybody going in and fiddling around with my source code, right? However, consensually, as a person who believes in human enhancement, I feel that I have the right. Once such options are available, to fiddle with my own source code if I want to, right? It seems like you're, you know, ultimately what you're talking about are recognizing for these new conscious beings, these new intelligences, the same basic human rights that we have. And maybe human is the wrong word, maybe it's the right word, I don't know. But it's basic, what we currently in this world today call basic human rights.
Pretty much, and you know, and as well, while I'm focusing as well specifically on personhood-based entities, it can extend even to more simpler life forms as well. You know, even if it's like one can make a case that, you know, squirrels and even potentially some insects might have just the tiniest spark of conscious awareness. Even that might be obviously then worthy of, you know, consideration in terms of how they're treated. And I'm just always worried, you know, that in as we're experimenting on these things in computer labs on an AC of some sort, that even these kind of tiny sparks of life could be abused in some sort of a way. And in fact, there is a writer out there, Metzinger, and unfortunately his first name escapes me right now, but Metzinger argues that, in fact, it's because we can never actually really properly identify consciousness and know the torment or condition of an AC as it's emerging, we should never create one in the first place. Now, that's a very challenging, and that's obviously clearly a very limiting proposition to put forth. But that, I mentioned that because that's what some people are thinking about these days. So it's going to be a very complicated issue, for sure.
Well, no one should ever have children because they might have an unhappy life, would be my response to that. So
very interesting, yes.
George, as I knew it would, the time has absolutely flown by. We're actually at the end of our hour, but we thank you so much for being with us, and we'll We'll look forward to having you on again. I hope much sooner than last time.
Yeah, and if anyone is, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, if anyone thinks it's premature to bring in an ethicist, geneticist Lee Sweeney is saying half the emails he's getting nowadays are from athletes. So, I mean, enhancement is upon us. We need to be thinking about the ethics of this now and not waiting. So,
agreed.
Yeah.
Good point.
Well, thanks again, guys, for having me.
Thank you, George. Pleasure as always. Stephen, what do we got going on with music this evening?
The music tonight is from Leslie Engel, and the song is Inside for You.
Inside for You by Leslie Engel. Thank you, Stephen. Thanks to everyone who participated in our chat room this evening and who listened live. We will be back again at the regular time next week. We look forward to being with you all again, and until then, live to see it.
Better than anything I would find, but I just have to laugh.